First of all, this is Walt Bowman. I am Walt Bowman, and this is the last in a series of sessions on the Eucharist. The general theme has been give us tomorrow's bread today, and today we're talking about the manner of the Eucharist, Reformation, Reform, and Renewal. Herb and Carl have a hymn for us, and everybody's got one, and this is the last word. Is that right?
It's the last word.
It connects
what Walter was saying to us from time to time about the Eucharist located in the Book of Revelation, and so just letting those things come together. The last word, the last light, the Lamb, all of that, and Holy Communion. It starts with thine, and what always moves off of the thine is then what? And then. So it's thine and then. Thank you, Walter.
All right, here we go. Carl? Yes,
okay, let me play it through once and just hum along, and then we'll sing it.
Carl learns these so fast. today, let me try to put today's session into some kind of perspective for us, and I'll go back and just say in a sentence or two what I've tried to do each day. On Monday, when we talked about the meaning of the Lord's Supper, I tried to say that the meaning of the Lord's Supper is the way Jesus shares with his community his own fate, his destiny. That's the meaning of the meal ritual. Or you can put it a lot of ways. He identifies himself with his community so that what happens to him happens to his community, both in terms of his way of being and in terms of the final outcome, the destiny. He lets them in on what is about to happen on the cross, and they continue to be let in on that as they celebrate this meal. That's the meaning. On Tuesday, I tried to talk about the ministers of this meal. That's us. Everybody. We are the ministers. It is not a performance for the benefit of an audience by a few or a single person, few people or a single person. It is rather the ministry of the whole community that is coming to expression here. And the title for the leader of this community then is president, presiding minister. That is one who organizes the ministry in such a way that everybody is involved in it. The kind of thing that Mary talks about, Mary Schramm, in evoking gifts, that's the notion of the ministry of the Eucharist. Then on Wednesday we tried to talk about the message of the Eucharist, that the ritual itself, the meal itself, is already a message, and the concern, the question is, what is the character and quality of that message? Paul reminds the Corinthians that the character of the message in their eating and drinking is nothing less than the sacrifice of Christ. He reminds them what he had also received, that on the night he was betrayed, Jesus took the bread and blessed it and gave it to them and talked to the Corinthians once again about that giving. Now, he says, if you are not available, even available to being taken advantage of, to being had, you are missing the point of the meal. You are not in on the meal. It isn't the Lord's Supper that you are celebrating, he says. So the message is our participation in Christ's way of being in the world. And then yesterday I tried to talk about the Eucharist and mission. And I tried to say that the mission of the church is not to gain members, but to be the bearers of the gospel, that is, to witness to the gospel enterprise in the world. I used words like God's forgiving ministry, which is really a way of including those who had been alienated or are alienated and excluded. The compassionate ministry. One of the theme books for the summer is Matthew Fox's A Spirituality Named Compassion, and be marvelous to connect his understanding of compassion with that mission of the Eucharist. Compassion, justice, peace, stewardship of the earth in a caring and careful way. The goal, the goal of the church is to bear witness to the dawning of the kingdom. Tomorrow's bread today already. To bear witness to the dawning of the kingdom in these enterprises. Forgiveness, compassion, justice, peace, stewardship. And when we invite people, we are not saying, join the church so you can be saved when you die. We are saying, join us, get in on this community's witness to these kinds of things. That is evangelism. That is the doing of the evangel in the world. We are enlisted in that by the offering of ourselves in the Eucharist. so that the offering is really the way we set the table with us once again, and are sent from the table, shaped by Christ's own giving of himself. Now today I want to turn to what this might look like in a ritual if I really had my druthers. That is, if I could put something together that would look like the Lord's Supper the way I might envision it. I want to start with another little reading from O.E. Jigs and Juleps. This one is called An Afternoon Stroll. I have it by McFadden, but I think Macmillan is the current publisher. So mine is an older copy already. Virginia Carey Hudson, 10-year-old girl, writes, "When I go strolling down to the post office to buy stamps to write to my cousins, my mother says, 'Don't walk on the courthouse side. That is where the checker players sit.' When I get to the pansy bed, my mother calls, 'And don't walk past the barber shop. That is where the men take off their collars.' And when I get to the linden trees, she yells out, 'Don't pass the saloon. That is where the door is sawed off at the top and the bottom and the music box is.' So I walk in the middle of the street and jump the stepping stones. And when I get back, my mother says, 'Oh, your best ankle strap slippers, they are covered with dust. Some people sure are hard to please. If the courthouse is on one side of the street and the barber shop and the saloon are on the other side of the street and I can't walk in the middle, I guess my mother wants me to fly to the places I go, just like St. Francis of Assisi." At least that's what the Catholics say. But the priest drinks all the wine at their church, and maybe he was just seeing things. Ooh. Not anymore. Strolling is walking slow and easy, like getting married. I guess walking slow getting married is because it gives you time maybe to change your mind. You stroll when you are a baby sitting in your carriage. You stroll when you are a young lady and have a beau. And then you stroll when you are an old lady and it doesn't matter where you are going or when you get back. When you stroll, you get dressed up. Only when I stroll up Holton Street, I wear my fighting clothes. Holton Street is where I have my worst trouble. That is another part of town. That is where the Campbellites live. They asked me to go to their old church party, and my mother made me go, and I wore my hat, and it was summer. And Alice Coleman laughed because I had my hat on, and I said to her, I said, 'You shouldn't go in church without your hat.' And she said, 'You should do.' And I said, 'You shouldn't.' And she said, 'You should.' And I said, 'You shouldn't.' And then she said, 'Who said so?' And I said, 'St. Paul said so.' And she said, 'He didn't.' And I said, 'He did.' And she said, 'He didn't.' And I said, 'He did.' And then she said, 'Fooey on St. Paul.' And that's when I slapped her." Once for St. Paul, and once for the whole state of Christ Church Universal. And then I pinched her for myself. The slapping was righteous indignation, but the pinch was my own and maybe the devil's idea. She ran home from the church party screaming and yelling, but I stayed and ate my ice cream. And Miss Billy called my mother up. Miss Billy is Alice's mother. Who ever heard of a mother named Billy? My mother made me sit in my chair one whole hour and read St. Paul. She said that it was a good day to read all of St. Paul. So I read about enduring all things and to behave yourself and not behave yourself unseemly. But I'll bet one thing. I'll bet St. Paul didn't know any Campbellites and never had to go strolling up Holton Street. All right. Well, the reason I read that is because it has to do with whether or not you can wear a hat in church. And that brings us immediately, you see the connection, to Reformation. I want to talk about three things today. First of all, some historical stuff, Luther's Reformation, and then contemporary reform, and thirdly, maybe renewal, and we'll melt reform and renewal together. Luther did not set out, as we know well today, did not set out to found a new church. And the Reformation was not a kind of 16th century version of the American Revolution. Luther really wanted reform of the church, and he wanted it particularly in the reform of the church's rituals, and most particularly, the Lord's Supper. Luther himself proposed two versions of the Lord's Supper, a Latin Mass, which he wrote in 1523, and a German Mass, Deutsche Messe, which he proposed in 1526. I wonder, really, whether Luther ever saw his proposals put into practice. Reform of the liturgy was no easier in the 16th century than it is today. I have often said that, you know, preachers can preach anything they want and the congregation won't revolt, but let them change one iota of the liturgy and there will be a massive protest. We had better keep doing things the way we have always done them. In my second parish, it was I was getting ready for my first confirmation there, and the organist was practicing, and he said, "Now, when precisely do you want me to ring the bell?" And I said, "What?" He said, "Well, you know, the moment of confirmation. We always ring the bell at the moment of confirmation." I said, "There is no moment of confirmation." "Oh," he said, "that's always been the custom. When the minister lays his hand on the head of the confirmand and says the name, that's the moment, and I bong a bell for each confirmand." I said, "There will be no bonging of bells tomorrow at the confirmation." Well, there wasn't any. And I had irate parents and grandparents at the door going out. "Was my daughter confirmed?" No bell was rung at the moment of confirmation. So one has to be very cautious about changing things in the liturgy. Luther made proposals, however, and at least by 1530, by the time of the Augsburg Confession, we know that some of those proposals were being put into practice in various territorial churches, and the princes who came to Augsburg to meet in parliament with the emperor came to defend essentially their practices. The Augsburg Confession has some 21 articles of church teaching, but all they were trying to demonstrate in the church teaching was that they hadn't changed anything in the teaching. The changes were in the practice, in the rituals, which in a sense shows us that that visions, ideas need embodiment, and they need to be embodied in our rituals. What were some of those changes? Well, for one thing, they had changed to the vernacular language. That is, masses were no longer said in Latin, but in the language of the people. This was an astonishing change because it invited congregational participation. Up to that time, if you didn't know Latin, and only a very few of the educated did, you spent the time in Mass saying your own prayers, following the action of the priest, waiting for that bell to ring, because then you knew you knelt at this time and knelt again and then stood up at the third bell. But now with the vernacular, we were inviting, or the church was inviting, congregational participation. Hymns were sung. The people in the 16th century knew very well that if you wanted to gain the support of the people, you put it into hymns. Luther unabashedly wrote long doctrinal hymns in which the whole of the Reformation teaching could be sung. Luther's musical collaborator, somebody by the name of Walther, together with Luther, put out the first sort of evangelical hymn book in 1525. The chalice was slowly restored to the laity. In Wittenberg, there were riots the first time that Melanchthon and Karlstadt tried to use the chalice in the Lord's Supper. People were used to only receiving the bread, not the cup. That was really for the priest. And so Luther came roaring back from his exile in the Wartburg Castle and preached a series of sermons in Wittenberg in March of 1522 to sort of calm things down again. And he went back to not using the chalice for some years until it could be properly, that is, without rioting, introduced to the congregation. Preaching became an essential feature of the Eucharist, of the Mass, once again. That was a reform. Luther dropped all confessions from his proposals. and sought to remove the practice of having a confession before the celebration of the Eucharist from the church orders of the 16th century. He wasn't very successful in that, because pretty soon it crept back in again. But confessions had actually been introduced by the Franks some centuries earlier into the Mass as a way of making themselves worthy to do this thing. So Luther said, that isn't what the Eucharist is about at all. It's for the unworthy. It's for the people who need God's inclusive word. So he dropped the confession at the beginning, the confession before the offering, and the confession before the receiving of the body of Christ. There were three places in the Mass where there had been a confession. Luther took them all out. We have an equally hard time today. I'm going to get to that in a minute, because I think a lot of people feel, oh, if that confession isn't there at the beginning, somehow we have missed the whole point of the Eucharist. Luther wanted confirmation abolished altogether, and because he didn't feel that it was a biblical rite at all, and that one received the Holy Spirit already in one's baptism. The confirmation was then only gradually reintroduced into the Lutheran churches. The last Lutheran church to reintroduce it, was the Church of Hamburg in 1832, like 300 years after confirmation was eliminated, Hamburg reintroduced it. Now we are again engaged in separating confirmation and admission to the Lord's Supper, so that in most parishes today, younger children are admitted to the Lord's Supper. I'm going to say more about that in my proposals in a moment. Luther and the Reformed churches dropped a lot of festivals from the calendar. Calendar reform was a big thing, because every festival meant you had a day off, like today at Holden, you see. And we can't have housekeeping take a day off, and we can't have the dining kitchen staff take a day off. I mean, that's just awful. So Luther and the reformers got the work ethic going by saying, fewer days off, everybody back to work. And so they reformed the calendar and dropped a lot of saints' days from the calendar, kept a lot too, but dropped a lot, and in general got people working on a six-day week. The biggest, most dramatic change in the 16th century was that priests were allowed to marry, and reformers who came to Augsburg then spent a special amount of time defending that innovation. At any rate, there was considerable innovation in the practices of the Lord's Supper over the decades and centuries in the Reformation. The interesting thing is that today most of those concerns, most of the concerns that the reformers had in the 16th century, have now been adopted by the Roman Catholic churches in the world as a result of the reforms of Vatican II. So that in many ways, if the reformers were alive today, they would probably say, good, no need for a reform movement anymore. It's pretty well happened. In principle, at least, the Catholic Church could even accept the marriage of clergy as they have in uniate churches. When we were in Germany, when Jan and I were in Germany last year, it was very difficult for us to tell really any significant difference between the liturgies in Roman Catholic churches and the liturgy of the LBW here in America. We went to masses. We heard really fine preaching of the gospel, marvelous congregational participation, full churches, people receiving communion with both bread and cup, hymns being sung, choirs, organ music. We felt very much at home in Catholic churches. In fact, more at home in Roman Catholic churches in Germany than we did in Lutheran churches, where some of these Reformation reforms have still not yet happened to the Lutheran church. In 1974, when I was in Louvain, Belgium, for a conference on Christian response to China, there were 50 Catholic and 50 Lutheran participants from all over the world. We had four Eucharists in the 5 days that we were together, two Roman Catholic, two Lutheran, and you couldn't tell the difference. Cardinal Sunens gave all of us permission to have intercommunion in those 4 days and even celebrated one of the Catholic Masses, preached a beautiful sermon, one of the best I have ever heard, on Pentecost and the presence of the Spirit of God in the church and in the world. And there we were, and you couldn't, at the Eucharist at least, you could not tell Protestant from Catholic. It was, in a sense, the Reformation had happened. Well, let me use that now to move into a kind of cook's tour of my own through the liturgy to ask, what might a liturgy look like today if we were really going to take LBW and put it into the best possible practice? Well, first of all, I think there would only be one service for a community on a Sunday morning. That is, we would gather the whole congregation at one time. Right away, that conflicts with the American practice of multiple services on a Sunday morning, although I notice that most of the Protestant churches in Columbus still only have one service. First Congregational has only an 11 o'clock service. The notion of several services, like 8 and 10:30 or 8:30 and 11, really gives us a kind of cafeteria notion once again instead of a community notion. Two settings, you see, for mealtime. One of my best favorite stories is the story of the boy who comes to church with his mother and says, Mother, what is this banner in the narthex with all these stars on it? And the mother says, well, each star is for one of the young men of our parish who died in the service. Oh, which service, he says, 8:30 or 11? Well, the notion of multiple services frequently gives a parish a sense of importance. Oh, we are so big that we have to have three services on Sunday, 8, 9:30, and 11. But it really, in a sense, breaks the congregation up into three separate congregations. I could understand three congregations using a single building, but I think we had better be quite clear that in a very real way, we now have two or three congregations. Otherwise, we're going to be just thinking cafeteria. So first proposal I would have is that the congregation gathers in a single gathering on Sunday morning. Probably I would also move Sunday school out of Sunday. Sunday schools began really as a way, Robert Rakes wanted this as a way for children who were working all week in factories and mines and stores, wanted the Sunday school as a time for these children to learn to read and write and do arithmetic. That was the beginning of Sunday school. So, the Protestants in the 19th century in this country, who turned Sunday school into sort of Tom Sawyer version of it, really had their basic religious instruction being given in the public schools. Archbishop Hughes in New York recognized very well in the 1840s that the public schools were really Protestant schools, and that's why he fought so hard to start Catholic schools in addition, alongside of the public schools. Well, they were, for a long time, Protestant schools. Robert Lynn's history of the Sunday school tells us a lot about that. Only in recent decades, have the public schools been secularized, and so the whole burden of religious instruction has now fallen on the Sunday school, which really, in a sense, can't handle it. We need, I think, better vehicles for religious instruction and weekday programs, late afternoon or evening programs are probably better for religious instruction of our children. Best of all would be teach the parents and let the parents do the instructing, but the whole community gathers, and that means the children. Not Sunday school for the kids and church for the adults, but the children, too, are a part of the gathering and a part of the ritual. I think if I really had my... First of all, I think that children can respond marvelously to the rituals of the Eucharist. They can learn the hymns that we all sing and sing them with joy. They can participate in the actions of the liturgy. I'm not so sure I'd let them listen to sermons, but I surely would let them be in on the liturgy. Maybe we could have storytelling time for younger children so that they could leave while the adults are having a sermon. And then everybody come back together again at the time for the hymn of the day or the offering, especially by the time of the offering. Well, no, because when we get to it, I want to say something about an offertory procession, and the children again could be very much a part of that. But I would want children to be admitted as early as possible to all of the rituals of the Eucharist, especially to the meal. We have now moved to fifth grade communion for most Lutheran parishes, but that really was a kind of a first step. The principles on the basis of which children are admitted to communion at fifth grade could also admit them at age five. And the new communion practices statement adopted by the ALC and the LCA says it's really up to the parents and the pastor and the children to decide when they are ready. And I think parents could ready their children and instruct them and then bring them to the table as early as possible. I think children can eat and drink and thus tell the story of the gospel sooner than they can verbalize it. In my sabbatical, I spent a month in a parish in Madison just to find out what it was like to be in a parish again for a while, and it was wonderful. But the pastor said, one of the things you get to do is fifth grade First Communion class. I was terrified. But it really worked out very well because we talked a lot about telling the story, telling their own story, how the story of Jesus intersects with their own story, and then how they become the storytellers as they eat and drink, right out of 1 Corinthians. And we had a marvelous time together. But I think we could have done that just as well with five-year-olds and had them be a part of the telling of the story. So as early as possible, I think, children should be included in the meal. The building would have a big narthex. Oh, yes, Erling. Well, probably not. I think I would want to say when children are old enough to walk and to have some sense of story and of being wanted, that, it seems to me, would be the main point. I think we are giving a bad message to our children when their parents get to eat and drink something, but they don't. So I would want to say when they are aware of being wanted at that table, that this is Jesus' meal and Jesus wants them, that's the age at which I would probably begin to admit them. Okay? Narthex. In the Middle Ages, the market square was the narthex. It was the vestibule. It was the place where everybody gathered. It was where you met everybody. It was where you stood and talked and before and after the gathering. And then, so you didn't need a large narthex. But the churches where they are located today, our towns are and villages and cities are somewhat diffuse and Main Street is a far cry from a market square. So it seems to me that what we need to do is to provide an entering place, a welcoming place. That's really what the narthex is. I was in a church near Watertown, Wisconsin, a couple of months ago, and they installed in there, they built a new building, and it looks exactly like I would envision a building for the church to be. You don't build a church, by the way. You build a house for the church. I had a friend whose parish building program. All their literature was a house for the church. They knew very well that the church was not the building. But this building near Watertown, it just is my vision of a house for the church. In the big narthex, which was a warm and welcoming place, they had a coffee bar. At first, the building committee was horrified. They said, a coffee bar? You know, the narthex? Kitchens, yes, they could understand that, off in the parish hall. But in the narthex, it is now the most popular place. Wonderful. Church starts at 8:30. That is, coffee is ready at 8:30. The entrance hymn is really sung at 9 o'clock, but people come at 8:30 because there is coffee, and there are some rolls, and you can stand around with a cup of coffee and get reacquainted with the people. Robert Worley has a book called A Gathering of Strangers as a book on the church, and I think in many ways that's really the case today. We do not live and work with each other in the kind of intimacy that characterized village or even small town life in the Middle Ages and the Reformation period. We have to understand that the total population of Wittenberg, which was a university town in Luther's day, was under 3,000 people. So today we need to re-knit our relationships in the community. And the half hour or so before the entrance hymn begins is the time to do that. If I were the pastor of a congregation, I would have my vestments on when the first people came. I would have my sermon notes already in place. I would have looked up everything that I needed to look up, and I would be out there in the narthex, drinking coffee, greeting people, ready to go, but now available to get people to talking with each other. The assisting ministers, too, should be there. Congregations need this, and so they appoint lay people to be greeters. I think that's all right. I mean, I think we should have all the greeters we can have. But the president, the presiding minister of the liturgy, ought to be most involved in greeting and facilitating, and the assisting minister in listening to the kinds of things people are talking about, listening for agenda items for the prayers. That's what happens as the people gather. If there are visitors, they ought to be introduced to some members who will then sit with them and show them the little idiosyncrasies of the local gathering to make them feel at home and welcome. The pastor or the presiding minister might get the names of visitors too in advance so that she can introduce them when the liturgy begins, introduce them to the whole congregation at the appropriate time. When you have had about a half hour of coffee drinking and sharing and greeting and talking and re-knitting relationships and meeting new people and so on, then, of course, it would be time for the entrance rite. And LBW has one. The entrance rite is a hymn, a greeting, now a formal liturgical greeting, you can sing one or another of the canticles that are in there. This is the feast if it's Easter time or something, and the prayer of the day, and then everybody sits down. The organist playing some prelude to the hymn could signal that now it's time for the coffee cups to be put away and everybody to get in and grab their hymnal. That's the conclusion of the entrance rite. Begins with coffee and ends with the prayer of the day. Then everybody sits. Now the presiding minister can say a word or two about the character of the day, introduce any visitors who are present so that the congregation can greet them. I would applaud for them the way we do here at Holden. I think that's marvelous. We need lots more applause in the church. Applause is really the way you say amen, or we're with you, or you're in on it, or something. And I think we should do more applauding. I would like it if we would applaud baptisms. And I was at an ordination not long ago where we had prolonged applause for the ordinand. And I would applaud weddings, and I would applaud anything that there is to applaud. But first of all, the visitors, as they might be introduced. Now the congregation would be ready for the lessons, and there would be a lector to read them, having the theme of the day sort of introduced by the presiding minister. The lector reads the lessons. Whoever is preaching on that day would read the gospel. And I deliberately say whoever is preaching, because not all of the preaching has to be done by the presiding minister. He is there to facilitate ministries. And some of those ministries are going to come from people in the congregation who have a word for that day. Or it might come from someone who is invited into the congregation to have a word. I wouldn't invite a presiding minister, but I would on occasion invite preachers in, and maybe even unexpected preachers, maybe even preachers who might tend to say some hard words to us on occasion, words that that we need to hear, but might not come from within the congregation. If we're a fairly comfortable, white, middle-class congregation, I might sometimes invite some poor or some blacks or some Chicanos or something in to give us the word for that day. I think it would really be marvelous, since we have sort of segregated housing patterns and our parishes are largely residential, for us even to pair ourselves off now with parishes that are quite different from us. If we're middle class and white and affluent, pair ourselves off with an inner city black parish, maybe even of another denomination, so that we get some cultural enrichment. Jan and I bought our house in an integrated area of Columbus because we didn't want our children to be culturally deprived. We wanted them to go to school with black boys and girls, and because that's the kind of world we want to grow up in. So if the congregation is to have some kind of reality, maybe you will invite in a congregation that you might be paired with in some other part of your city or some other locality. But at any rate, some other people could be bearing the word on that day other than the presiding minister, and selecting who gives the word for the day might be one of the tasks of the presiding minister and a liturgy committee. During the word, I probably would let the children go off someplace for a story time. Stories are good for them. They need to hear lots of stories, not much application. I don't like even having a teacher say, "Now, what does this story mean?" I would just tell them the stories. Jesus and the Ark, Noah being crucified, all kinds of wonderful stories. All right. But the point is that they get a large fund of stories. I would tell them not only about biblical characters, but I would tell them about Wilhelm Leah having this great vision of mission work, that you don't send out individual missionaries, you send out whole communities. So he recruited a bunch of Bavarians to go and settle in Michigan as missionaries to the Indians, farmers and artisans and craftsmen and teachers and families, and also a pastor and some teachers went too. They settled in Frankenmuth and Frankenhilfe and so on. Leah made only one little mistake. He forgot that the Indians were nomads, and after he had his Bavarians settled there, the Indians all moved away, and so they were reduced to chicken suppers. But Frankenmuth has the most famous chicken suppers in the Midwest, but it's hardly an exalted mission enterprise. Poor Leah. I would tell them those kind of stories too, so that they know that the great heroes of Lutheranism have lots of things wrong with them, and it's all right for children to have things wrong too. And then after the sermon, the hymn of the day is sung. Now this is the great hymn, dressed up with trumpets, as Carl did on Sunday evening, dress it up in any way we can. The prayers, I have already said, the prayers are really the congregation's business agenda. Here is where I would have the church council come with its recommendations for things that are part of the congregation's ministry, where the needs of individual members would be lifted up to God, and always the question asked, who is attending to these things? Then I would have the church flexible enough so that the greeting of peace could take as long as necessary. Herb's poem that we read a couple of nights ago. And for this, we need reasonable freedom of movement. My ideal building doesn't have pews in it. It has chairs so that people can get around easily and have some movement. Then comes the time for the offering, and it really should be a time for an offertory procession. Everybody who wants to give something gives it at this point in the service. If there are baptisms on three or four Sundays out of the year, or marriages, or ordinations, or commissionings, or whatever, we would do it here at this point where the hymn of the day and the prayers and the peace is shared. And so the hymn for that day would be a baptismal hymn or a wedding hymn or a commissioning hymn or an ordination hymn. And the greeting, the prayers would relate then to what we had just done. And the greeting of peace would be for the person or persons whom we are baptizing or whose marriage we are celebrating. I have been at weddings where the LBW was used, where they didn't have a receiving line at the door. They didn't need one. I mean, that's Emily Post. Why should she be the presiding minister for Christian rights? We had the gathering or the receiving line right in the middle of the service at that point where the wedding was, the marriage was complete, and everybody came and hugged the bride and the groom, and it was wonderful. I would do that for baptismal candidates, for confirmations, for ordinations, for commissionings, for whatever. That's the time to greet and welcome. The offertory then is where we bring ourselves forward in a procession, not a parade. A parade is where some people are watching and other people are marching. A procession is where everybody's in it. And that's what we need at the time of the offering, to say, here we are, Lord, make us your people, shape us in your way. We would probably then, after the prayers, setting aside the bread and the cup, come forward for the meal. And I would probably do this at stations. Instead of standing around, I would have with the minister and the assisting minister moving, I would have the ministers standing still and the people moving past them to receive the cup and the bread. So that we have a single, continuous, communal celebration of the meal. There might be a variety of ways to do this, but I would want it to be as expeditiously done as possible. Then very quickly ascending, go in peace, serve the Lord. Everybody says, thanks be to God, and you are off once again at your task, your ministry in the world. Shaped now once again by the great story of the gospel, Jesus' gift of himself for us. Well, that's my vision. I really wanted to leave us some time today. We have almost until the bell rings for your vision, so I'm ready to start. Over here.
I really appreciate what you're saying, and I'm from Seattle, and we had many times signs and needs showing that people really wanted to talk and share joys as well as pains before the church started. But there wasn't enough time, and
yes,
the organist would complain that prelude is going, we have to listen, don't gossip so much. But you know, I think what really our ills are, at least in our case, is we are not flexible enough. Yeah. I think we don't, and I think people see a ritual in that too, a safety and a security blanket, or whatever you want to call it, they enjoy that. So we have always these pull and whatever you call it. But I'm going to try again.
Good.
to loosen this up, because I think that's one wonderful way to find out what people really are all about. I think that opens up, and we can maybe find out what their last week was all about. And I really appreciate that.
Exactly.
It's nothing new, but we haven't really tried to change it yet. I'm going to try it again.
Good. You've caught the point. Wonderful. All right. Over here, please.
I was very happy at what you said this morning, because a lot of this is happening in my little church. We're the only AELC church in the state of Washington.
Oh, all right.
And we, during some months, from June until December, we have koinonia in the morning, as you suggested, before we go into the service. And also talking about Lord and the age, letting little children come to the Lord's table. The account of the church board instruction and the study of this. So our morning Bible class studied it for 3 months, and in the fall we're going to start communing with the younger children.
Wonderful.
Yes,
I'm glad to get some to start off with some support, but I don't want to inhibit now somebody who has a lot of questions about what we're doing. Ruth, fire away.
Why is the sermon hymn the big dressed up hymn of the day?
Why did you call it the sermon hymn? It's not called that. It's simply the hymn of the day. It's
the hymn of the day. Okay.
It's the main hymn.
Okay, I just didn't know why.
Oh, why is it called the hymn of the day?
Why is that hymn the big dressed up hymn of the day?
Well, what would be your alternative?
I don't know. I'm just curious as to why that becomes the focal point.
In one sense, really, you might just be singing only one hymn. If you want in the entrance rite, you can just simply have a greeting and this is the feast or glory to God in the highest, so that you might just be singing that one hymn. But it's a hymn that generally is suggested to relate to the theme of the lessons, and we ought to sing it, I think, with a reasonable amount of celebrative character.
See, it's called Hymn of the Day now, but it's still, I mean, I slipped even and just said sermon hymn. And I think that's the attitude of that happens a lot of, okay, now we've had the sermon, now we're going to highlight the sermon, and the focal point always being on the sermon, that's what we come to church for is the sermon.
Did you get that impression from what I said this morning? That
oh, no. But
good.
I'm saying that perhaps by putting the focus on that hymn and that singing, that we're still going to be focusing on the sermon. I don't know. I raise the question.
Carl.
Yeah, the concept of the word, phrase, sermon, hymn, is one that we could well get rid of.
Oh, I know.
Because it's a concept which does exactly what you say. But the hymn of the day, historically, is the hymn which related to the lessons or the season of the year and the thrust of the theme of that day. And I think when we begin to see it in that way, then we're going to have it straight. What happens sometimes is pastors, the hymn of the day should certainly relate to the sermon because the sermon ought to relate to the lessons. And when they're all doing that, then you've got it's all working in one direction.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is when the lessons are read and the pastor says, well, none of those lessons turned me on this week. I'll preach about something else. And then he wants to pick a hymn which supports his sermon, which is unrelated to everything else. That's where the problem is.
Yeah, it seems to me that that all of the hymns need to be related. I mean, all of what we're doing in a particular service needs to be related to the focus of the readings so that we take a theme and a sense and a mood and try to draw it out throughout the whole liturgy.
The point is that you have the collective experience of the church has already developed themes. We call it church year.
Yeah.
I mean that's where one of the, in a sense, one of the givens of how we organize our worship.
And we have 156 of them, because we have a 3-year cycle.
Right.
So we have lots of themes. Mary?
Well, I think I'd like to join your church folks. It sounds great. The thing that I would disagree with is this kind of cafeterial style of communing. You said you didn't like cafeterias.
Services.
It seems to me that's what that is. When we've done that at home, and there have been a lot of people just think that they're just passing by and something's been given. Whereas if you're in a circle community and then those that are finished come and take the place, that seems to be to me a more continuous circle and symbolically has a lot more going for it than, I mean, why do you like people just passing by that are ministers, picking up their ministers?
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe it would even be best if we just passed the bread and the cup among the people. That is to say, one participant in the meal would pass the bread and the cup to another. Maybe that would be the ideal. I guess I see some logistical problems maybe in having people stand in a circle as we do here at Holden. It just seems to me, I don't know, it seems to me to be more orderly, but I don't have any rationale for it. And that's why I'm open to your suggestion. John?
As long as you're having your druthers and you can build your church too. There's an Episcopal church in Washington, D.C. that did two things. First of all, they took out the first three pews. They kept the pews, but they took out the first three, put indoor-outdoor carpet, had all kinds of non-noise-making toys, and parents with kids are down on the floor in front of you and are very much part of the service, but you kind of look over them and they're not distracting. I thought that
wonderful.
Was the first step. Secondly, they opened up the whole front of the chancel. The chancel area, the choir is out of there now. They have a circle that must be 30 feet across with an altar in the middle. It was a large space. And for the Eucharist, everybody comes forward and stands around this altar singing, and there's good rock music over the loudspeakers part of the time, but anyway, it's a festive thing. You come, take the bread and the wine, and step back into the circle, but the whole congregation is standing and visiting during the distribution, and then you go back to your seats. In other words, it's probably 10 or 15 minutes. You are all up front. At least it has a start toward coming between what you and Mary just said, and it had a good feel the day I was there.
Wonderful. I had an almost identical experience at Collegeville when the campus ministers were there just a couple of weeks ago. The church at Collegeville has a huge platform on which the table is located. And when the time came for the great Thanksgiving, we all came up out of our pews and gathered around the table. There must have been 250 people standing around the table there for the Thanksgiving, and then we just stayed up there during the communion.
We do that for a baptism at Holden. Everyone comes, stands all around for the entire baptismal service. So you could do the same thing at the Eucharist.
Exactly.
This time of the year, I don't think we have the space for it. But at other times,
right.
like when there's 200 people in the village, and you can arrange the chairs and the pews to have the space for it, it's a kind of
yeah, wonderful. That it seems to me, maybe would really be more ideal than any other. Ruth, once again?
Well,
and then I'm going to come downstairs.
Also to Mary's, I had a different feeling when the congregation that I was participating in last year did the kind of passing by, as you would put it, that Walt talked. But the feeling was people came up the center aisle, and there was this constant movement of surrounding each other then, as you would come up the center aisle and go around and go back, and there would be a circle around the people who were still in the pews. And there was a whole feeling of a circle that started in the front where the presiding minister and the assisting minister was, but continued all the way through the back to where the pews were. So the circle engulfed the congregation instead of being around the table. And in that situation, it worked very well. There was a sense of everybody being part of it.
I think what's happening here is that we're trying to visualize different ways of maybe accomplishing the same goal, but I see us all having an identical vision. Erling?
Since we're always in church, kind of like mummies, pressed for time. What? What about having separate places for a serving, like we do at conventions? Does that break up the body?
Well, you're talking, I think, probably about large groups of people. I can see different stations, yes, but maybe the kind of vision I have is for a relatively small gathering of people. I'm really thinking here that we're talking about 250 people, maybe as a parish. Maybe that's about as big as a community can be and still try to be a community. Incidentally, if anybody wonders whether all this can be done in an hour, the answer is no. But if, you know, if the gathering begins at 9 and you don't plan to be home till 11, I think we could start with coffee at 9 and be home by 11. And that would be the time set aside. All right. Yes, here, over here first and then over here.
An interesting point that you made about evangelism when we're talking about the church community is once we have established this, our community, our Christian community within the parish, you know, our evangelism then becomes bringing people outside of the Christian community in and having them share with us this joyous experience, as opposed to, you know, giving them a turn or burn type of an attitude.
Yeah.
And I guess my question, I'm just posing this, is, do we then assume that once they come in to the Christian community and have this shared experience with us, that they then become an active part of it and are then believers? Or, you know, what balance do we need to have? You kind of track it?
Yes, but that's another whole series.
It was just something that struck me that I wanted to bring up.
But I think you're on the right track, because the point then, first of all, the community does the gospel and is the bearer of the gospel and bears witness to the gospel. Evangelism in that sense then means inviting people to join us in this enterprise. And what that might look like in terms of catechumenate and baptism and reception, that's another whole story, but I think you're on the right track, yes.
Question?
Please,
yeah.
Fire.
Suppose that one went home and suggested that lay people preach and leave the Eucharist. I'm assuming that one would get some arguments against it, and I'd like to know what to say. Are there any rules against it, or is it just simply a matter of ministers being used to doing it?
Well, first of all, yeah, you're fighting an enormously long and deeply entrenched tradition. I guess my understanding would be, first of all, that as far as lay preaching is concerned, we're much more used to something like that. And there is a long tradition of that, too. Preaching has never been limited to the ordained. And so here I think there probably wouldn't be any great difficulty. But I think it's important for us to identify the kinds of words which the community needs to hear, and then to seek out people who have the gift for saying that particular word and going outside of the congregation, if there's nobody within the congregation that can say that word. And I think this is one of the things that a congregation can well do. A worship committee and a pastor responsible for the fullness of the Word of God in that congregation would be looking for the people who could say it. I don't think there's any serious traditional or even conceptual problem there. With regard to lay people presiding, the assumption that I have begun with is that the Eucharist is that ritual which shapes the life and ministry of a particular community, so that the presiders of the Eucharist should be people intimately involved with and connected with the ministry of that congregation. Now, under normal circumstances, I don't have a lot of objection to that being the person who is called as the pastor and therefore the leader of the ministry of this group of people. But if you're between pastors, or if on some Sundays the pastor is gone, I would not then invite someone from outside of the ministry to come and preside at the Eucharist. I would say, who might be the next leaders in line? Chairman of the church council comes to mind. And say, those people within the community ought to preside over the leadership. Now, it seems to me that that you might have some uneasiness about this,
but I don't really see anything in principle wrong with what I'm suggesting, at least within the Lutheran tradition.
But we talk about pulpit and altar fellowship, which sort of implies that we have fellowship with certain other synods or denominations, and we'll share pulpits and the altar with them. They're ordained. I mean, that's usually what I've read it as. Isn't that what we're saying? Or shouldn't we have been saying that?
Yes.
I don't like the idea, but it seems to me that would be an argument.
Well, no, but and I think that that's a you're raising a good point. But what we mean by that is that the ministry of the local community is bigger than its own local concerns and interests. The fullness of God at Holden shares ministry with Lutheran congregations in the Northwest, with Lutheran congregations all over America, with Lutheran congregations all over the world, and finally with Christians all over the world. One of the ways in which that gets signaled and symbolized is through the pastors functioning in part as symbols of that linkage and bringing a word from outside and representing. John was just at an installation in Chelan on Sunday. That's part of the way in which fullness of God links itself with other concerns. So that's the meaning behind that. It's not, I don't think, primarily a question of who's legally able to do this or that. That misses the point. So I would use then the clergy leadership in a congregation to symbolize our unity in ministry and mission with many other parishes all over the world, but not as a way of saying who has a right to do what in our midst. I think as long as you designate certain people as presiding ministers, so, you know, not everybody, but some people are designated, and as long as you say this is only for our local ministry here, then I think you would be operating out of the understanding that I'm working.
Warren?
Steve?
About the designation of a presiding minister. Maybe I don't understand the concept of presiding minister. But when I think of a flock of sheep, the person who leads, or the sheep that leads, is the one on the edge of the circle all the time. You watch a group of sheep.
Yeah.
And if there's a shepherd, it's not a man in the image that I have. The good shepherd is not a human being who has been ordained, but rather the presence of God among us. And I don't understand the need for creating a church hierarchy that you're describing. It seems to me rather that I minister to the church, but I don't wear the collar. And where's the distinction come? I guess I'm uncomfortable with that standing between you and God.
Now you're raising a whole new set of questions. And earlier in the week, when I tried to talk about ministers, I didn't talk about creating a hierarchy or putting someone between you and God, but rather simply some persons are designated to provide facilitating leadership for the ministry of the whole community. But you're opening up a can of worms that would take us a long time to get into.
What?
Over here. Where? All right, Larry.
Most of what you've been talking about, new what Steve just mentioned, may well have. Well, it'd be interesting to go back to where we started with Luther. I went down to check to see if one of the volumes was there in Luther's works, and it's presently out. But it was brought to our attention a couple of weeks ago by John Yoder that where Luther proposes first the reform of the Latin Mass. And then secondly, the reform of the German Mass, as you mentioned at the outset. What hasn't been taken up yet was the third thing that Luther said. He said, if there were enough Christians around, and there aren't yet, what I would like to see is a house church movement.
Yeah.
Where the folks all get together in clusters, and they celebrate Eucharist together, and they're ministers to one another, and they have a common fellowship and a common task. And so we've spent, 400 years on reform of the Latin Mass and reform of the German Mass, but we haven't gotten to the small groups of clustered, disciplined Christians who carry on the ministry among themselves and as those small units.
Yes.
I think most of what you've been talking about fits that. And most of the suggestions here that what people want to see also fit that kind of proposal. But it does mean that you don't, and maybe the problem was that we thought that by our parish and denominational structure, you gather people into the church, and then there you make them Christians somehow or another. And so you make the terms of membership very easy so as to get them in and preach the word to them, so that evangelism takes place in the church instead of from the church to the world. Whereas Luther's third proposal is you make your stipulation at the very outset. You join the church on the terms of
doing the gospel.
Discipline, clustered, mission, small, community. Those are the terms of entering in the first place. So maybe we don't get beyond the reform of the Deutsche Messe.
Marvelous.
The old model. Yeah.
That is really a good word. I'm almost... It's nearly time for brunch, is it? And I wonder if maybe Larry's word shouldn't be the last word, unless somebody has an urgent thing to say yet. If not, then I want to thank you for this marvelous week together, and have brunch.